All right. We are back and it's a full house here. We got Eric Kress, we got Adam Telfer, and the one and only Joseph Kim. So I'm going to ask how Eric and Adam are doing. I'm not going to ask how JK is doing because we did a whole goddamn podcast about how JK is doing. So we're not talking about JK in this episode. So Eric, tell me more about your kids' basketball games, right?
Our basketball games, yes. I think they've had like 30 games already in the last couple of months. It's just unbelievable. And they were killing it. So they were like, I don't know, 19-2 in the third grade league. So they're number one in Northern California right now.
So that's your retirement fund, right?
Nah, you know, he's still half white, dude. Has no hops. You know, he's just really tall right now. So I don't know. I don't know what his future is going to be in the NBA, but he's definitely competitive in third grade at 5'2".
Well, how about Adam? How's life? You're in London right now, right?
Yeah, I'm in London. It's been good, actually. I'm doing a little bit of a European tour at the moment. Always good to come out here. Mm-hmm. Managed to go back to Berlin, hanging with a bunch of Woogas. So it's always good.
That's awesome. Any rumors?
Rumors? Not too much. I think they're definitely enjoying the Playtika acquisition. So they're pretty happy.
Yeah. That's a cushy acquisition that leaves them some space, but we're not here to talk about Wooga. We're here, at least not in this episode. In this episode, we're going to tackle on some interesting topics. Sorry, JK, I just want to read through this. I haven't been on this podcast for a while, but so JK got us interesting topics. So we're going to talk about Microsoft and Sony forming a cloud gaming and AI partnership. Now that's a crazy title. Anyway, that's Eric. We're going to talk about Minecraft Earth. I don't know anything about Minecraft Earth. Sounds like, is that a mobile game? Anyway, we'll hear about that later. And Pokemon Masters, everything we know so far. And finally, we're going to talk about something really interesting, and that is Riccardo Zacconi to step down as a CEO of King. And that'll be probably our last topic. But let's start with something ubiquitous, which is the Microsoft and Sony forming a cloud gaming partnership. Eric, do you want to talk more about this?
Sure. Yeah. So basically, there was some kind of like official announcement from the bigwigs at Sony and Microsoft about a partnership around Azure and AI. The reporting around this was like so wacky, right? You know, the details were really scarce. And there's a lot of coverage that was speculative about what was going on here. Here's what we kind of know. Sony Corporate signed a memorandum of understanding to use Microsoft Azure for hosting and services and AI. In my opinion, like Amazon was the partner for Sony historically, so it's actually kind of a big loss for Amazon and their AWS system. They say that the decision was primarily related to cost, and Sony PlayStation had absolutely no idea that this was going on, which is the funniest part of the whole thing. They had no idea that they were signing this a partnership with their biggest competitor, right? It's ridiculous, right? In a separate presentation during the earnings call, Sony said they had the infrastructure to support 5 million subs for its flailing PlayStation Now platform. So in essence, my takeaway is that this has nothing to do with PlayStation Now necessarily, particularly in the short term, maybe in the long term. But this was not a decision based upon what the gaming company needs. This was primarily a cost decision from Sony to get the best system possible for the best cost for delivering all their hosting and live services. So Sony is likely partnering with Microsoft to reduce costs and obviously leverage their technology for longer term investment in the streaming services. And it just shows how archaic their Sony's structure is and very how political things are, because if a decision like this should be made with the gaming guys, right? To make sure that it aligns with their strategy on how they're rolling out PlayStation and also on their PlayStation Now plans. And in essence, by partnering with Microsoft, they're giving a piece of every single revenue associated with PlayStation, potentially anyway, to their biggest competitor. So I don't know. This is kind of a big deal in some ways. And I think it's also an acknowledgement that Sony's technology is not strong enough to stand alone, right? They're basically you know, their acquisition was good for where it is right now, but ultimately they need to partner with someone with better tech in order to deliver the next gen type streaming services. And there was a lot of press that this actually validates Google Stadia. I think it's kind of on the contrary. It creates another, maybe it does validate them to some degree, but actually creates them another competitor that's on equal footing from a technology perspective. And ultimately, Sony has vastly superior content to deliver as well. So it's actually a really bad news for Stadia. I think it's really good news for Microsoft. And it's also, I think, really bad news for Sony, right? Because now, not only are they acknowledging the fact that their infrastructure and their technology is not as good as and they need to leverage Microsoft's tech, but also they're actually paying out Microsoft, you know, on all their hosting and live services. So anyway, I want to be clear. I'm making a lot of assumptions and I'm making a lot of speculations here because there was just not a lot of detail. It was a memory of my understanding. They haven't even signed an official deal. This thing may fall through. And now maybe that the gaming guys know that they're going to, you know, do this deal with Microsoft. They're going to say, no, we're not doing this. But who knows what will happen? But that's kind of my take. What do you think, JK?
Yeah, from my perspective, I agree with you. It's very unusual for two really direct competitors to be collaborating in the way that they are. And so maybe you're right. It's like there was some kind of miscommunication or something like that happened. But, you know, if they kind of went into this, you know, with full knowledge, it does make me believe that, you know, both Microsoft and Sony are probably worried about getting displaced if there is some kind of structural shift based upon cloud-based gaming. So from that perspective, if they're collaborating to help fight off Google, Apple, Amazon, whoever else becomes a threat, then that makes sense. But also agree with you that Microsoft definitely has the most to gain, given, you know, they're already kind of losing the console wars to Sony and Nintendo. And on the Sony side, you know, you can view it as a negative, but also to your point about their technical infrastructure, it's clearly not there. So, you know, maybe it's okay for them as well. Besides that, I don't have much else to say. Mishka or Adam, you guys got anything?
Nope. No, nothing.
Okay.
No, not really.
I mean, it just goes like back to the bingo. Like, these are the games that I don't play. So, Minecraft?
Minecraft. All right, let me get started on this. So, this week there's a Wired article titled Minecraft Earth Wants to Be the Next Pokemon Go, But Bigger. Very exciting headline. The actual article summary is essentially explaining the history and how Minecraft Earth came to be. Minecraft Earth is an upcoming game from Microsoft and the Minecraft team, which is their take on the Pokemon Go geolocation craze, with essentially taking the IP and the audience of Minecraft and bringing it over to Pokemon Go location-based gaming. Just to kind of set the stage about Minecraft and kind of the size of it. It's about 10 years old now. It sold 176 million copies over that time. It's a premium product, of course, and currently is sitting at about 90 million MAU. But if you actually look at the history and the trends of where Minecraft is, when we think about, you know, like Apex versus Fortnite, actually Minecraft was hit far harder by Fortnite than any other game. You can see actually just on Twitch stats just how deep the impact Fortnite was towards their audience. So you can definitely assume that Microsoft is on the back heel right now with their Minecraft audience and trying to figure out how to capture that audience once again. So with this game, it's definitely the first new Minecraft experience since the original. You can kind of ignore Telltale and some of the other kind of off-brand games that were created. It was created in part by Alex Kipman. There was a few other names in the article, but this is the one that kind of stood out to me. He's the creator of HoloLens, as well as kind of was involved in the Kinect development, if you remember those two major Microsoft projects. So I'll go into this a little bit into my take, but of course, this means that I think this project is a bit more focused on the novelty of the technology, maybe not actually trying to create a game, which was kind of what the plague was of Kinect. The article actually goes into the details over the many failed and restarted attempts since 2015, roughly, to bring augmented reality to the Minecraft IP. So it kind of reads actually more like almost like a university or like a company with a lot of internal struggles about how to actually come up with a vision of a product that would supersede Minecraft. But overall, in the end, it also explains a little bit about the game. It has some videos, which I would encourage you to check out. But essentially, it's a location-based game. So think very much Pokemon Go, which is a game about collecting and building. So collecting aspects is moving around the world. So similar to Pokemon Go or Jurassic Park World Alive, you're moving to different locations in the real world, which allows you to collect certain blocks. Those blocks and resources can then be used to create, say, custom Minecraft buildings, structures, worlds, adventures that you can then go on. So collection, which allows you to kind of customize and create. It has a lot of collaborative building elements, and this is what a lot of the article is actually focusing on, is when, say, you go over to a friend's house or you're over with a friend and you can actually be building a Minecraft building together in AR. And actually from the video, this actually looks pretty cool in terms of placing structures and gets around a lot of the issues with augmented reality controls on a mobile device. As well as you can kind of invite friends to work and collaborate in these worlds, and they can even say destroy or take some of your blocks. So all very interesting concepts, but I would definitely say this has a lot of red flags, at least from my perspective as a, say, more game designer. So my take on Minecraft Earth in terms of the concept and what we know so far, on day one, I would definitely expect there to be a lot of phallic Minecraft buildings. I think when we think back to any of these kind of user-generated content platforms, you're giving an entire, you're pretty much giving the planet a public space in which to put graffiti out there, to build out all these different Minecraft buildings. And I think it's going to be pretty quick before people start abusing that power. But besides the obvious user-generated content issues, my biggest worry from this is trying to define what exactly the game is from it. So Minecraft, if you think about that, the original game was actually an amazing kind of survival crafting and collection game just on its own in terms of moving around the world, like breaking apart blocks, using those resources to craft and create a whole new world. The actual customization and building element, it was something more of, say, the long tail element, and definitely a good aspiration for players, but not necessarily the core that brought players into the game to begin with. So AR10 games have actually tended to kind of be kind of plagued by this, where they end up focusing too much on kind of the technical novelty of AR and not actually trying to make a long-lasting game. Pokemon Go is actually one of the best examples of this, the best game that kind of broke outside of this, because they took what was good about location-based gaming in AR, but the actual core game and what it is a very well-functioning mobile gacha collection game, and it functions just on its own with it. Even before they added battle elements, it was still a very, very good game on its own. Minecraft Earth is a little bit odd in terms of how it's implementing this. It seems like it has some elements of that. We'll see when the game actually comes out in terms of collecting and leveling up to kind of collect or to actually build up some of these worlds. But overall, the system seems pretty simple, with the main output just being kind of creative expression. So overall, I would say this is very risky. There are some adventures you can go on by yourself, but these seem pretty pre-placed, and I think this will kind of make or break the experience. So beyond that, if you kind of have a very simple system tying this all together, I would say monetization will most likely be a major weak point. And the article even explains a little bit about this, saying that they'll have some build plates and blocks that you can purchase, but that seems pretty slim in comparison to Pokemon Go. But we'll see. It's available in beta this summer, but we'll see at that point. Eric, do you want to go?
Sure. You know, not much to add here, but I do think that this is really kind of a true AR game, because so in essence, it's kind of unique from that perspective. I still don't think that Pokemon Go is an AR game, even though every presentation I've seen about AR says that, you know, includes that revenue as part of the market, but whatever. I see like some challenges. I think I agree with you. The monetization design looks really weak. Pokemon Go had consumables to keep people playing and spending. And much more of a chase than it seems that Minecraft has, but it's hard to say given how early this is. The other thing I would add is that for Minecraft, they're basically competing against themselves, right? There was really no alternative for Pokemon Go at the time. Pokemon, that was the experience for Pokemon, and that maintains the experience for quite a while now until the new release of Pokemon this holiday. So, you know, Minecraft is an amazing game. You can play on all platforms. So basically they have to compete against themselves on all their different platforms or on the mobile device. And the other thing is AR is unproven. So it's like, we don't know how well AR can do. And if you believe the Pokemon Go style of game is an AR game, every sequel that's come out since then has been terrible, right? You know, with big, huge licenses like Jurassic Park, why am I blanking on names these days? But what's the
Walking Dead?
Oh my gosh, Walking Dead. Sorry, those sequels or those iterations on trying to take advantage of what the Pokemon Go did just bombed, you know. And they're huge licenses and not poorly designed games necessarily. So anyway, I think it's going to be interesting to see how if they can break through on this. And these are really, really hard games to predict. So but we'll see how the beta goes over the summer.
Cool. And from my perspective, I'm very skeptical of long-term success. I think I read into the situation pretty much what you had read into it, Adam, which is too much focus on the sort of technical aspect. And so I could 100% be wrong, but it did sound like this game was more of a tech demo looking for a game rather than a game trying to be a game. It sounded like a few technically and sort of BD-oriented people got caught up in that sort of whiz-bang HoloLens demo and, you know, just kind of took it from there. And so while you can never count out top-tier IP like Minecraft, but without much more context besides what we read in that article, you know, I personally usually bank on key personnel. And what I wasn't reading from there was who the lead designers were and really mainly reading more about a few folks that were kind of technical and BD focused, trying to overcome a lot of very interesting technical challenges. So generally speaking, I would say those situations in my experience don't tend to do very well. But, you know, as a product, I'm definitely rooting for it. My kids love Minecraft and I'd love for a way to have them have more reasons to get out of the house. So I think that'd be great. And I would just say the one other concern that I would have for the game would be the audience. So if you look at Facebook audience insights and you know, and Facebook actually only captures people who are 18 or over. But if you look at Facebook audience insights for Pokemon Go, for example, and use that as a point of comparison, see that 73% of Facebook players of Pokemon Go have a college degree. And then we also, as Adam, you noted before, that there was actually quite a bit of cannibalization from Fortnite, which also would tend to indicate that Minecraft skews super young. So then, you know, if you have a game like Pokemon Go that's potentially achieving a lot of their success through an older audience and Minecraft, which skews super young, is there, if we're comparing those two opportunities, then, will the younger players monetize and play this kind of game where you have to go outside with phones? So not clear on that part. But so I guess long story short, I'm skeptical, but definitely hope that the product does well, just because I think it's kind of an interesting product. Mishka, did you have any other thoughts, or should we roll on?
No, I think you guys covered everything. It's I'm not very, very, very understanding of the location-based games. Like, you can't get me out with a phone. I'm sorry. So.
All right. So moving on. Pokemon Masters: Everything We Know So Far by a publication called iMore. And just a quick summary of this article. So there was a surprise Pokemon event on May 28th where the Pokemon company announced a couple of new products, one which was called Pokemon Go Plus. Kind of a strange product to announce, but it seems like it's an activity tracker that includes sleep tracking and somehow helps train Pokemon in your sleep. And then they also announced a Pokemon game being developed by DNA called Pokemon Masters. And it's a battle game that tries to incorporate all of the trainers in every past Pokemon game into a single game. And what do we know about the game so far? Well, very little, but there were some screenshots in that article that showed a 3v3 battle. 3v3 meaning like three trainers with an associated Pokemon battling against three others, so not three players. In the battles, actions seem pretty simple. So for each of the trainers with a Pokemon, there was like an attack, special attack, and potion option. And there seemed to be like a shared power meter that seems to enable the special attacks, but shared across the three trainers that you control. So release date info is not very clear, just sometime in 2019, but more info should be released about the game later this month. And so my own take on this is that I think this is good news, despite some of the other Pokemon battle games, which haven't done super well. I do think DNA knows how to monetize, and this seems to be a more straight up Pokemon battle experience than some of the other games that have been released. So I'm actually fairly optimistic on this one and feel it could actually break out both in Japan and in the West. But we'll see. What do you guys think, Adam?
Yeah, so the Nod thing is interesting, especially since I think last podcast I definitely ripped into Mario Kart Tour quite a bit. So it's a similar developer for there. So that definitely gives me a little bit less faith. But I guess this is with the Pokemon company itself rather than Nintendo, which are very different. But it will be, I think I'm also with you, JK, in terms of the design here. It looks like they've got a strong basis. So the switch to go towards 3v3 versus 1v1, which would be, say, a traditional Pokemon game, was the right choice. I've gone into this quite a bit on Deconstructor of Fun blog posts about how important it is to kind of have that kind of wide turn-based battle to keep things interesting. And it was a smart decision to go towards 3v3. As well as moving into this like all trainers thing. So hopefully this means you can actually collect like a ton of your favorite trainers from the series. I would equate this something towards like Final Fantasy Exvius, which was a fairly successful game for Square. In terms of as a Pokemon fan myself, I probably couldn't name a ton of Pokemon trainers that I would want to collect, but I'm assuming after kind of the first initial fall off, they can kind of create some value because they just have so many different types of Pokemon that players will want to be collecting. So there should be quite a bit of reason to collect as many different trainers as you can. So overall, it looks like actually could be a competent Pokemon RPG game with a strong RPG design with loot boxes, gacha, etc. From Pokemon Company. But I've also been proven wrong. So they've shown a bunch of games in the past which have a strong core, which look like it could actually monetize, and most of them haven't really succeeded. That would be Pokemon Duel, Pokemon Trading Card Game, Pokemon Quest, were all attempts to do similar but definitely failed. I forget which developers developed each one of those, but I think only Pokemon Duel was with Dana, and that wasn't really a strong that wasn't a strong game. So overall, I'm optimistic, but I'd really like to know more. Eric, do you want to go?
Yeah, I think I almost agree with everything you said. They're historically, they just have not had much success. Pokemon Company has not had success of bringing games to mobile. And to be clear, this is absolutely not a Nintendo game. Nintendo owns, like, I think 20% of Pokemon Company, but they are not at all involved with the development of this game, it seems. And DNA is not a premier partner. You know, this is not like, they're not replicating the success of Fire Emblem with this game, generally speaking. And the only real concern I have that, you know, the incremental point of view from what you said is that this is really bad timing for a Pokemon game. You know, if the game is actually successful and gets the fans involved, I mean, they're releasing one of their biggest games of this generation of Switch this holiday. So they don't want to compete against themselves. So I don't know. And again, because they're not the same company, and people seem to forget this, is that they don't have, you know, they're not really concerned about what Nintendo's doing. They're just doing their own thing. So I don't think, because, you know, in November when this new game comes out, they don't want to have a competing product on mobile. I think that'd be a bad idea. So, yeah, we'll see how that all nets out. And we'll see if they actually can finally create a good Pokemon game on mobile.
So looking at this, I mean, I'm not a
MK.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Pokemon in any way, so I can look at it objectively. And then the thing is, like, there's four Pokemon games launched on mobile alone, and what we can see is the Pokemon Shuffle has been. I mean, there's Pokemon Shuffle, there's Pokemon Duel, and there's Pokemon Quest. And altogether, these three games throughout all their lifetimes have generated about close to 40 million in in lifetime net revenue and about 70 million in installs. So that doesn't blow your hair back. Of course, if you had Pokemon Go, that's a whole different story. So it kind of seems like they're one out of three, and majority of the revenue seems to be coming from, it's kind of divided between US and Japan. So it's not a, it doesn't seem like a Marvel IP where you basically slap it on a game. It doesn't matter whether it's a puzzle RPG or a regular RPG or MMORPG or RPG or card collection RPG. It's still going to do relatively well. In this case, it seems a little bit more of a hit and miss. Seems still like a solid IP for RPGs, but it's hard to predict that this would be something major, and it will always be smaller than Pokemon Go. So again, just not a big fan, and I'm just looking at it objectively. It's like one out of four. So till date. All right. Anything to add, guys? Wow. It's like silence. So before this podcast started, Eric was very adamant that we cannot speak on top of each other. And now as the senior on this podcast, everybody's afraid to say anything now. All right. So let's move to the last one. And that is Ricardo Zacconi stepping down as the CEO of King. So Ricardo is the CEO, was the CEO and actually is a co-founder of King, and he will be stepping down as the CEO in July. Zacconi has been in charge of the Candy Crush developer for 16 years, and he will in the future take the position as a chairman. As during his time, he's definitely been super successful. Super successful CEO, and he's been actually the only CEO of the company since 2003. And as we know, in November 2015, King was acquired for $5.9 billion. So it's definitely a mission accomplished for Zacconi. But it's kind of the way I see it. There's kind of two reasons why he's stepping down, apart from the mission accomplished, and it's now 4 years since the acquisition. I think number one is that it's a part of this larger Activision leadership team shuffle. So in January this year, Activision Blizzard restructured into three business units with a new president appointed for each of them. The Call of Duty executive vice president, Rob Kostich, was named Activision president. The former CFO and chief strategy officer, Humam Saknini, I'm hoping I'm not butchering his name, has been named King Digital's president. So that's under the King was under that. And the CFO, Dennis Durkin, has been named president of Activision Blizzard's emerging businesses. And he will be also the CFO of the company. And as we've seen during the past year, the Blizzard was seeing more and more of Activision influence seep into the company. And the goal has been clearly to reduce the costs and make more games at the same time. And that was kind of coincided with Morheim's departure from the company. I think the same elements are probably at play with King. Of course, King is in a different position as Blizzard. They're definitely extremely profitable. I'm sure Blizzard is as well, but you know, King is probably on a little bit of another level due to the nature of the business. But for sure, there has been cost cutting at King, and we've seen that in form of closure of studios and even layoffs, despite the company being highly profitable. There's no dip in revenues. There's nothing like that. But still, they went through that same bad exercise of reducing the 8% of the workforce. So that's number one, is the larger Activision leadership team shuffle. The other one is performance. So when you look at King, over the past 2 years, the revenue has stayed pretty stable at around 90 to 120 million net revenue a month. Nevertheless, the decline since January 2019 has been quite significant in terms of those games. I'm not sure why it's so, but during the last quarter, the company's revenue have definitely declined. But nevertheless, it's more about the growth of the Candy Crush saga combined with inability to launch new hit franchises and really the inability to expand outside the puzzle category. So we've seen King launch Paradise Bay back in the day, sort of a heyday competitor. We've seen them struggle in launching mid-core games, actually failed to launch a single mid-core game. And there was this infamous Call of Duty project or projects that were going on, and they were recruiting for those around the world, but failed to ship anything. And when it comes to performance, we have to talk about the competitors and King's market share in the category that they pretty much, you know, developed and helped to grow. Their market share has been decreasing year by year, whether it's Peak coming in with their you know, focus of blast and match games, whether it's Playrix coming out with their sort of a more of like a narrative, visual storytelling, little bit of a simulation type of games, or whether it's Matching to Mansion for Fox, I don't remember, Firecraft Studio, whatever it is, that little small developer. So whether it's those coming in with their ultra aggressive marketing practices, nevertheless, King has been losing its share in the market. So while their revenue has been stable, the overall size of the market has grown, so they're taking a smaller piece of the pie. So overall, kind of combining this to performance and the leadership shuffle, we have to say that the looking from the sidelines, King is definitely not what it was. Today's King is not what it used to be. And one thing that we knew King from, and at least personally I knew King from, was that they were extremely fast at iterating on their web platform. They're trying a lot of new things, trying a lot of new elements, and then pushing those games out to a wider audience on different platforms. At the moment, we see King barely do a couple of soft launch a year, and that the amount of soft launch they've been doing is almost halved every year to a point where they're probably going to soft launch one game maybe this year. So it's if the trend continues. So that's one thing, and the second one is that before they used to have a wide variety of puzzle games. Everything you can match, everything you can blast, everything you can shoot, they would do it, and all the colors were popping, and then more games were coming out and so forth. But now it just seems like they're focused on one or two key franchises. It's Candy Crush this, Candy Crush that, Soda this, Soda that, and maybe some Farm Hero Saga, but we really haven't seen them, you know, expand around those. And that's naturally the Activision approach of just, you know, really focusing on the franchises and instead of having this robust buffet of different match games. Now, of course, I might be wrong, and this is just me being nostalgic and thinking about what King was back in the days, but you have to say that it's different. It doesn't matter whether today is better or worse. It's just, it's very different than the company that Zacconi and the guys originally started. So that's my take. Adam?
Yeah, I'm just going to say this is coming from you, from Rovio, that has been working on Angry Birds games for the last decade. In terms of adding the Angry Birds IP to pretty much every single game that they could.
That's pretty good.
I think you've seen firsthand in terms of the power of a lasting franchise and a lasting IP can have on a game, right? I'm not going to comment too much on Zacconi and kind of his cultural impact internally. I completely agree with you in terms of him being a part of just a massive transition for King from kind of their web game roots to today. Like, while I was actually working at Wooga, I was there during that transition of Candy Crush from Facebook to mobile, really saw that kind of like leapfrog of an entire genre on casual mobile. And it was huge kudos to that team for what they did with Candy Crush. I'm just going to debate you on that in terms of, like, the old timey kind of strategy being the way that they should go back to. I just don't see that being successful in the market anymore. Like, if you think about their old strategy, they launch a game on royalgames.com. They see, you know, initial metrics from that web game, and then they decide whether to do a production of that game. That production lasts, you know, maybe half a year to get that game out to mobile. And then there you have, you know, Pet Rescue Saga. I think there was like, what was it? Rubber Ducky Saga. There was that Mexican bean one where they were combining stuff. Like they were going pretty wide, even within kind of the matching genre. And if you think about matching games over the last like multiple decades, thinking back even back to PopCap, with all of those games and even Playrix back then, that was their bread and butter, was to continually deliver novelty onto real arcade and onto all those web platforms or downloadable PC platforms to try to keep players coming back. It worked then, but it just doesn't work now. The major IP of Candy Crush just can't really, there's no replacement for that. And I know from rumors, at least, is that they do plenty of behind-the-scenes soft launches. So in terms of us looking at App Annie and saying, oh, King, you know, only did two soft launches, I'm pretty sure they're actually doing substantially more than that, just not under the name of King. And even just within looking at the King name on the soft launches, I think their bets are pretty smart within the matching genre. They have that story-focused Candy Crush game coming out, which I think is smart. There has been like more simulation focused Farm Heroes. So, and in terms of like the blast areas, like Toy Blast and Angry Birds Blast, it's not as if they're not trying. They have Candy Crush Blast style games coming out. They're just not hitting, which definitely gives me a bit more pause. But overall, like their strategy there, they are going, I'd say, wide enough within the matching genre. Just the metrics bar within King is extremely high. CC was definitely an anomaly. And I think Candy Crush Friends is probably the closest that they've come to actually hitting the benchmarks right out of the gate. So I think it's just kind of the classic innovator's dilemma within King, where they have Candy Crush, they have their golden goose, and they're going to stick to that model as long as they can. And I think as Activision adds pressure just to make that golden goose as shiny as possible, they'll have less and less leeway to try other things.
I have to ask, like, do you see it kind of like, I mean, I agree with you, and I wasn't saying that the old King was better than the new King. I'm just saying that the new King is different than the old King, which is normal. But do you think, you mentioned that their threshold is way higher. Do you think they have like the similar kind of dilemma that Supercell is having? Not dilemma, but almost like a mental block where they can only launch gigantic genre defining or just, you know, gigantic games, and that is kind of like a blocker to release anything because it has to be bigger than something you've ever done before, and it's just harder than to release another innovative approach on puzzle.
Yeah, as being a part of a number of different companies that really always focus on this by saying, like, they put that sentence on the wall and they say, we only launch top 25 games and that's the only thing that we ever do, right? That's a blocker to release because I think everybody gets into plenty of cycles about, right, like rethinking everything from their core game loop. And it usually turns into comping what successful titles end up being and then going too close to what's already been successful instead of saying, like, how do we break out and create something that has a shot? Because whenever you look at something that breaks out, it typically has, plenty of reference to the market, but has clear contrast to what's being out there. It is a very difficult part of releasing games. But I think it's also just the nature of the market that we live in. I think if you want to, if the only successful games you can make internally breakout hits, which would be the case with King, right? Like making a small hit that only generates 10 to 20K a day is just not interesting to King. They would rather for every team member on that team be putting that into a new event in Candy Crush, right? It's the nature of games as a service. It's the nature of free to play. So I understand where the strategy comes from, but I don't envy the designers that have to come up with new games in that space.
I get it. All right. Eric?
Yeah, I mean, I'll make one comment on what you guys are talking about. I think the city-state model, which I've said a million times, is that, King has like been in their lane since the beginning, right? Making great and amazing puzzle games one after the other, and they just haven't done anything else. I think their mistake was not doing acquisitions of studios that can do something else. I think the notion of putting someone that's made puzzle games for, you know, a decade on a strategy game is just absurd, right? That's just not going to happen. The success vectors are completely different. I don't think there's any, skill sets that are evolved out of doing puzzle game that'll help you on RPG or strategy, you know, and maybe I'm being, you know, hyperbolic here, but whatever. My point is that they've tried many, many other types of games and failed miserably. And I think what they should have done to grow their business is acquire teams similar to what Zynga is doing right now, and others. Having said that, the article basically is talking about this guy leaving. And I just want to be clear with the audience, like, this is normal, right? The guy got acquired 4 years ago. And then the fact that he stuck around this long is kind of a miracle, right? You know, they make these transition plans, you know, ahead of time, in which they have a 4-year lockup and they do all their performance bonuses, et cetera. The guy's a bajillionaire, you know? I'd get the F out of D, you know, if I was him, like, do something else, right? Why do you want a headache when you don't have to have the headache, right? So, you know, Activision really can't get a break right now because this is like one of their divisions that's actually doing well. And so him leaving is probably not a good PR thing for them. But ultimately, I don't think this is all a negative. I think, you know, they probably have a really deep bench that can manage these puzzle games and backfill those positions. And I also do not think this has anything to do with performance because, again, they're the only division that's actually performing. But my only concern longer term is this, if Activision tries to get involved with more of their, you know, legions of McKinsey and Bain consultants that don't know one thing about video games come in and try to manage their products or their, you know, their pipeline, that concerns me. But my understanding is they pretty much left King alone, primarily because they performed well. And when things, you know, when divisions are performing well, Bobby just lets them do their thing. So compared to other challenges that Activision has with Call of Duty development, and I think this upcoming Blizzard fiasco, I think King is really far down the list in terms of, you know, drawing their attention and disruption per se. So anyway, that's kind of my quick take.
Perfect. That's all. That's all we have.
That's it, guys.
So JK, I know we didn't talk about you today, but do you have any updates on how's life?
Yeah, so life's good. You know, there were a couple of, well, that LinkedIn post that I, you know, that I posted last Monday kind of went a little crazy. And then, you know, that podcast that we recorded with you, I got a lot of really great, you know, feedback, a lot of great comments. And yeah, it's actually been pretty, it was a super busy week, which, you know, I talk about in my YouTube channel, but it's just kind of exciting times.
Awesome.
So we'll see what happens.
Awesome. Glad to hear. On that note, we have a new episode.
I think we
broke the rules.
Sorry. I think the bingo sheet actually just got completed. JK just talked about his YouTube channel.
Yeah. Just give him more views. Give the poor man some views. But anyways, and you're making your videos that are like either like 50 minutes or 1 minute video. So you're definitely trying all the different things, and we'll maybe and sequential testing some,
yeah,
but
A/B testing.
Anyways, there's a new post on Deconstructor Fun and Mobile Free to Play about Empires and Puzzles. Really awesome post by Neek. So go and check that one out and tune in next week when we talk about This Week in Games. So thank you, and thank you guys.